Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Jonathan Carmody, Erica's managing editor at Infralogic, and today I'm delighted to welcome Sadiq Wahba, the founder of I-Squared Capital. I-Squared is an asset manager operating in the infrastructure and energy spaces with over $50 billion of assets under management across various different strategies. Sadiq, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and thanks, Jonathan, for having me.
Sadiq, I've always found I-Squared to be quite an interesting investor because of the vast array of sectors that you cover. I don't think you're the typical kind of core infrastructure investor that just buys highways, power plants, and things like that. So I'm really interested to dig into a little bit of the diversity of your investment strategies and how you find value in the market. But recently, you've tapped into a new area to raise capital for your investments, the wealth sector, high net worth individuals. So you've become the latest infrastructure asset manager to tap this sector to support your investments. With regards to the integration of new pools of capital into the sector, how do you see the democratization of infrastructure accelerating over the next decade? And what does broader access to essential inflation-linked assets mean for the evolution of private markets, particularly mid-market opportunities that were historically overlooked?
It's a full question, which has different components to it, and let me try and address each one of them separately. The first one I would say is, when you look at the public-private policies associated with the development of infrastructure assets, in most countries, those type of infrastructures that you've mentioned have tended to be done by the government. And by government, I mean it could be the federal government or state government or city government or municipalities or whatever. And with a few exceptions, which is UK, Australia, Canada, and some other countries, that is still the case, where the private sector hasn't played a particularly big role. I think that's a real shame from different perspectives. Not just because of opportunities to invest in and the kind of returns you can get, but from a policy perspective, you want to have the consumer participate in their own type of infrastructure. So if a road or an airport is owned by a wider group, insurance companies, pension funds, or frankly, even listed, then you have the ability for people to have a much better transparency of what's going on. Because on top of the regulatory framework, you have the typical capital structure that accompanies these kinds of investments. And I think that's an extremely important element because it then helps in several ways: raising capital, improving efficiency, and increasing transparency. So when you look at the participation of the consumers, the voters in infrastructure assets that have been privatized in one form or another, in economies like UK, Canada, to some extent, and Australia, it's much, much higher. And I would posit to you that in general, as a general proposition, it has been a better outcome than otherwise. And I say that because as long as these assets tend to be invested by the same entity, meaning the one who owns the asset is the one who regulates it and is the one who manages it, you have conflict of interest, you don't have the ability to manage it properly and objectively. And I think that's what you have when, in general, public entities end up owning some of these type of assets. Having those owned by a wider group, I think, is a huge positive. The second thing is, there is a lack of capital, and that's a strange thing to say because people say, oh my gosh, do we have enough opportunities? And many people say we don't. You're right that there may not be enough, in certain sectors, actionable opportunities, but the demand for capital for these kinds of infrastructure is huge. And I'm sure we'll talk about the super cycle we're in now. So governments do not have the means to invest continuously in infrastructure, especially maintaining existing one, upgrading them, and then on top of it, having to create new infrastructure with new technology that we're not quite sure of. So the responsibilities of governments at all level has become an increasingly much bigger and much more complicated. And so having another source of capital is important. That source of capital can come from the pension funds, insurance companies, sovereign funds, But to the extent that we can bring in the broader capital markets, I think that it's a plus. And so from the perspective of the consumer, when you talk about democratization of infrastructure, I think it's the right word because you're able to offer these opportunities, not just from the perspective of a consumer versus an institutional investor. So I do not have access to it because it's only very large investors that can. So that's one advantage. But the other one is it gives greater participation in the development of your own infrastructure in your own local region. So for example, if I'm an investor, even if it's like $1,000 in a road in my county or in my airport, I feel that I have the ability to participate in the development. No different than you vote on schools, you vote on this, you vote on that. And I think that's the important thing, which I think hopefully is going to happen over the coming years.
And to that end, Sadek, you've launched I2 Open Infra, which is specifically designed to attract that high wealth individual. Talk to me a little bit about how that team will work alongside your existing infrastructure strategies. I know you've brought in new private wealth professionals to man that team. They'll be working closely with the partners at your firm, as well as other financial advisors and banks. Talk to me a little bit about how that's integrated into the strategy.
Absolutely. The idea is to be able to create an evergreen type fund, which have the ability to have greater liquidity than if you were in a closed-end fund, to have funds that have the ability to attract a broader set of investors than the typical institutional investors, where you have the ability to create a diversified portfolio and to create a yield associated with that. And I think the more of these products you have across the board, not just I2, but others, I think the more you're going to be able to have greater interest, greater activity from consumers in what's going on in the long-term policymaking of their infrastructure. And I think that's a positive thing. In addition, of course, to seek to get attractive risk-adjusted returns.
You mentioned there as well a couple of points about the kind of political environment. We'll come back to that a little bit later. But you highlighted the infrastructure super cycle that we've been talking about and the kind of reallocation of capital to the market. Decarbonization, digitization, and certainly supply chain realignment are driving this kind of once-in-a-generation infrastructure super cycle, as it's being called. I know in the press release when you put out about Open Infra, you cited the McKinsey report that said there was going to be $106 trillion, I believe, required by 2040. Let's talk a little bit about that. So from where you are, what is the capital reallocation that's needed? And how do the investors out there differ in how they capture long-term tangible value from these shifts in the market?
So you say capital reallocation. I'm not quite sure that's the right terminology. What do I mean by that? Your question, is there going to be a capital reallocation? My answer is the demand is so huge across all products in all regions, then it's not a question of reallocating capital. It's a question of accessing capital in a sustainable way. So I'll give you an example. Literally 3 years ago, no one was thinking about data centers in the way we're thinking about it now, AI-based data centers or data centers that serve AI processing. That's completely different. 3 years ago, power market in the United States was relatively flat. Demand has been flat, if not a little bit declining for last decade. That's not true just in the US. It's true in other industrial economies like Europe. In fact, 6, 7, 8 years ago, gas turbines were shut down because there wasn't enough demand and because of what was happening in terms of the spark spreads that you found in Europe. So the dynamics overnight practically has completely changed. And it's extraordinary, the massive demand that is required for investing in data centers today, principally in the US, but in Europe also, and so on, to be able to satisfy the AI needs. So that's one area. Associated with that is, of course, the power demand that is needed. Associated with that is the fact that in the US, there's been a somewhat of a stop on climate-related technologies and, more importantly, power generation being renewables and otherwise, and not batteries, incidentally. And that also puts a lot of pressure. which is not the case in other countries where China, for example, has decided to double down on renewable energy and needs a huge amount of capital in that front. So every country is on full speed in different type of sectors, and the amount of capital needed to be able to deploy that in a systematic way is not available. That's a very different story to say that the investable opportunities may not be that available. That is, depending on the sector, that may be true. In other words, yes, we need $100 trillion. Does that going to translate into $100 trillion of investable projects? Certainly not. In fact, you need $100 trillion. Even the government will not be able to fund that. And that's where you need to have a fundamental change in the structure of how these markets function, so that precisely you're able to unleash that $100 trillion to be able to satisfy the fundamental demand that is out there. So for me, it's not a reallocation of capital. It's restructuring the way in which we deploy infrastructure investment in such a way that we're able to allocate capital across all of the sectors, because every economy has a different issue. Some economies are exporters of energy, some are massive importers, some are exporters of minerals and require a lot of mining investment, some is the exact opposite. So when you look at it globally, that demand is massive, and we need to be able to find the ways in which we can open up the system so that capital can flow in.
That's a great answer. And yeah, a very detailed overview of where the market's going. As you said, it's a redefinition, isn't it, of global infrastructure and the alternative space more broadly. I think when I started working here probably 10 years ago, we were talking almost exclusively about public-private partnerships. We acquired another product to boost our energy capabilities around 2017. When we realized that was the direction of travel, I feel like we probably need to go and buy something related to digital infrastructure now to boost those qualities, because that's certainly one of the main focuses.
And think about it. Look, 10 years ago, there was the boom in shale, which in 2015 went down and has come back. There was a lull on LNG. I remember 20 years ago, or 15 years ago even, people weren't sure whether the US will have to continuously import LNG. Now it's the exact opposite. So there has been dramatic changes in the market, but at the end of the day, whether you're importing or exporting LNG, the fact is the demand for power has increased. So the US happens to be now a net export of LNG. Therefore, it needs to build that infrastructure. The receiving countries need to build that infrastructure to be able to receive that kind of production. And so things have changed. But on aggregate, you have continuous demand for energy, which is now boosted by technological changes through AI. You have aging population that has not changed, which requires you to be able to address, again, certain issues. You have massive urbanization and population moves, which require you to deal with urban infrastructure in a way that is efficient and productive. You have climate change, and you have to deal with that. I live in Miami, and we are faced with changes in climate, which is recognized by everyone, first and foremost by our governor, where we have to invest billions and billions of dollars to be able to deal with greater volatility in weather and hurricanes resulting from that, and so on and so forth. Fundamental changes in temperatures that affect basic infrastructure that are not used to that kind of massive swings in temperatures. So all of these things are happening. And that's why I'm saying we are in that super cycle, because the demand is continuously growing.
Yeah, so that's a great point. I wonder if the size of the storm that's barreling towards New York this weekend is something to do with climate change. It's often cited when these things occur. Well, good point, Sadek. And in terms of how you approach the space at I2, as I said, I think you take an interesting approach. You've invested in things more recently like tire recycling, carbon capture, and even manufacturing. In terms of what we were saying about redefining infrastructure investing and trying to accommodate all of the changes in technology and everything else, how is your criteria changing at I2? Have you changed your criteria, or are you merely updating it as you go along to accommodate all of these different shifts in technology and society?
What we do is we constantly update our priors. So we try to understand what exactly have we learned, what do we see in the market, what are the short-term trends, but also the long-term trends. And Right now, you see a lot of different factors. There is greater global uncertainty, and that's a fact. Tariff is another uncertainty where it's difficult to be able to measure the impact on the investments that you have, because no matter what you do, you have to import products to be able to build a power plant or whatever it is that you're looking to do. So there's always an import component wherever you are. And so there is uncertainty on a global basis about who's imposing what tariff and at what rate. You have, from a macroeconomic perspective, uncertainty around inflation. The US, for example, has an inflation of about 2.7. The Federal Reserve is looking to stabilize at around 2, as we all know. That's their benchmark. So are we seeing interest rates coming down or interest rates going up? Unclear. Yet, saying that, global economy seems to be doing not bad. You have the global economic growth forecast for 2026 at a little bit over 3%. The US economic growth is somewhere around 2.5 to 2.8, depending on the forecasts. The US has been able to reduce the trade deficit, being able to reduce the budget deficit as a percent of GDP. So you have an economy that is actually doing quite well, notwithstanding the uncertainty I've spoken about. But you can see where you have difficulty in projecting or forecasting some key macroeconomic variables, whether it's interest rates, inflation, the fact that you have debt to GDPs growing substantially over the last decade and continue to do so. The US has debt to GDP of somewhere around 124%. But then if you include the unfunded commitments on Social Security, which I one day will be a beneficiary of that. And so for me, that is a commitment on the part of the government, no different than a sovereign obligation. But then that number is not 124%, but 340%. So these are quite large numbers. So the fact is, we have been the beneficiary of fiscal expansion over the last decade. So for every good point, I can come up with a question mark if you want. And that means that you're at this inflection point. Nevertheless, when we look at making these investments at I2 Capital, we look at several things. Number one, we always look at measuring risk for our investments, not just on an individual basis, but on a relative basis, both across sectors and across regions. That has been a core element of our investment strategy. Risk diversification for us is our number one priority. You will generally not see I2 Capital investing massively in one sector or in one particular region. Of course, our biggest market is the United States, but we invest in Europe, we invest in Australia, we invest in Canada, we invest in high growth economies. So that diversification is extremely important. And within geographic diversification, we also have sectoral diversification. So think of this as creating a covariance matrix where we are able to, as much as possible, reduce the correlations between these various individual investments so that if A gets hit by some exogenous factor or even something that we didn't foresee, endogenous to the portfolio company, slow down in growth or something like that, then it's not impacted or it's not impacted in the same way on other assets. And that has been a key element. The second thing that we've been really thinking quite hard about is technology. So technology, in our view, is going to have and is having a major impact on the way infrastructure as a service is being delivered to the ultimate consumers. I think over the coming years, some of the technological changes, in the same way as we predict that it will unfortunately cause redundancy in labor, I think will cause some of the more traditional infrastructure assets to become stranded. And so we want to avoid that. We want to understand, not over the short term, but over the long run, what are the implications for the kinds of infrastructure investments we do, which is why we have a dedicated infra tech strategy that invests in technologies that have a direct impact on infrastructure. So that, I think, is a second element. A third element, which has been really a cornerstone of our approach, precisely because of that uncertainties that we face in the market, we tend to look for moderate leverage. And so when I look at the historical and the average leverage across our portfolio investments, it's around 40 to 45%. So these are some of the elements that we think of when we come to make these investments so that we can create a well-diversified portfolio.
I'm curious if you could say which of the sectors you think are going to become stranded, Sadek. That would be useful intelligence for our readers to learn about.
I don't want to give you a sort of generic answer, but I may have to. Any asset which at the end of the day is not able to integrate technology over the coming years is going to become a stranded asset.
Right.
So I'll give you the most obvious one is the transport-related sector. If you're going to be operating public transport in the same ways you've been doing for the last 30, 40 years, in my view, you're going to find yourself having lower productivity, lower efficiencies, and ultimately providing a service which is too costly and unable to maintain. And other countries will be able to be much smarter in terms of the delivery of efficient, intelligent public transport.
Excellent. Sadek, if we can pivot now to a little bit of the political scene and how the private markets and the public sector can maybe work a little bit more in tandem. I know this is something that you've opined about in other publications. In September 2022, you were appointed to the National Infrastructure Advisory Council. So you had intimate interactions with that side of the equation and the political side. We're seeing a shift in how the US government intervenes, as you said, moving beyond just subsidies towards taking direct equity stakes in strategic sectors like mining, semiconductors, and critical minerals, all massive priorities for this administration and the US government more broadly. So how do you interpret this new era of government investment, such as the government's investments in companies like Intel or MP Materials? And what does it mean for the cost of capital, competitiveness, and the role of private investors like yourselves in strategic industries?
Yes, it's a great question. And I just want to make one clarification. When you say political, I think it's very important to distinguish. For me, political involvement means that you become an elected official and you represent the people. But I think what people still say in my position, at least certainly what I've been doing, is really helping formulate policies and provide what I would call technocratic advice. What works, what doesn't work. Because at the end of the day, the political is supreme, meaning that it's the people who are elected by the people who make ultimately the decision. The question is, having made these decisions, how best to implement it and what are the different alternatives? And I think that's really where someone like myself, I like to think that I can play a very small role in trying to help think about what the kind of policies you have. So you bring up the question of this administration has been embarking on something that we have not seen in the United States in a long time and has generally been foreign to administrations over the last couple of decades, except in cases of emergency. So World War II, 2008, when there was the global financial crisis, the U.S. government intervened and effectively, directly and indirectly, took stakes into the entire financial sector through the TARP program, if people remember it. I personally think that what the administration is doing in terms of taking those direct stakes is actually a great idea. So let me explain why. There are two types of investments or two ways in which a government can invest and support infrastructure investments. Number one is through incentives, subsidies, production tax credits, as it happened in the renewable sector, where Congress came up and said, okay, I'll give you these tax credits if you do X, Y, and Z within a period of time, and so on and so forth. There are other ways in which the government says, I'll give you soft loans and so on. So all this has worked fine, but it has not been able to deal with what I would call the growing and nascent need to invest in strategic sectors from a national security perspective, where it's difficult to explain or to put a specific number on the economic value of investing in rare earth minerals that you can mine here in the United States. From a purely economic return, it may be cheaper to do it somewhere else. That may well be the case. But from a national security perspective, there is a realization that you need to be able to ensure the supply of these goods, whether because you've hit with something like COVID, where suddenly we saw the supply chains collapse, or for other defense reasons, national security reasons, which are, in my view, are perfectly valid. Those investments require a direct involvement from the government. And there is different ways to do it. The ideal way which this administration and previous administration, to be fair, discussed, was to create a specific, and I don't particularly like the name, but for purposes of this conversation, it will work, a sovereign fund that invests with the private sector in those sectors where the capital markets that we have in the US, which incidentally is the deepest capital market in the world, is not able to provide the answer that we're looking for. So in other words, the capital market fails, not because it's not efficient, or maybe inefficient, but I'm saying fails to address, purely from a national security business, the ability to make those kinds of investments. Okay, so short of having a national, a sovereign fund, what this administration said was, either I go the route of creating that large sovereign fund, and everyone is going to have 16 different opinions, and it's not clear whether Congress is able to pass that kind of bill. They took the existing resources and allocated directly to support some companies. I think that's a very good idea because they've supported companies in the mining sector, supporting companies in the tech sector, supported mining in the development of batteries and parts of batteries that you absolutely need to have in your own home country. All of these make sense. Is there a better way of doing it? Yes. Is this the second best because of the overall dynamics that we face in the US where it's difficult to have things go through parliament? The answer is yes, it is the best we have. So I think it's a smart way. Interestingly, people on one side of the aisle will say, oh, but it's not the role of government to invest in private sector. The market should do that. True, the market does it, except when we have national security considerations for which it's difficult to put an economic price to it. And then on the other side of the aisle, people say, why are you supporting private companies? You should support social endeavors to do that. But in fairness, that's what the previous administration did in the infrastructure bill, which is a $1.2 trillion bill to invest in infrastructure and upgrade existing infrastructure. And that was 100% funded by taxpayers through debt and the budget. So I think you have had both. I hope that we can go to the next level and have a more comprehensive strategy on how we want to be able to do that. But yes, the United States today is doing something that, to be fair, Europe has been doing for a long time. Japan has been doing for a long time. And of course, China is the principal country where it has a very close relationship with its state-owned entities, which by definition, they may be listed, but they're ultimately state-owned. So they have the ability to control many of these companies and incentivize them to make investments in areas that they otherwise would not have done.
I would be remiss if I didn't highlight the investment you made last year in Entech, the lithium ion separators manufacturing company. This was an investment that you said would power the first gigafactory that they're building in Indiana, I believe it is. And that was another good example of this. You invested, I think, around $800 million to acquire a majority stake in the business alongside the Department of Energy's Advanced Technology Vehicles Manufacturing Program loan of $1.3 billion. So over $2 billion leverage between the private and public sector for that investment. That really exemplifies what you're talking about, doesn't it, Sadek?
Absolutely. You have employment created in the state. You have technology that is being developed and manufacturing produced in the United States, specifically in a particular area where it's very expensive to import it from outside the US, simply because we do not have that. And it, in this particular case, it does make economic sense to be able to produce it, both from an economic perspective and from a national security perspective. So I think you've seen quite a few of these examples over the last 12 months or so. And like I said, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think the next phase would be to be able to do it in a much more systematic and comprehensive way, and where you're able to leverage the resources much more than what we're currently doing.
So as a final point, Sadek, I'd like to touch on something that covers all of the things that we've talked about really, but the digital economy and data centers specifically. Now, while iSquared is certainly an active investor in digital infrastructure assets more broadly, you haven't quite thrown yourself headfirst into the AI-driven trade like a lot of other infrastructure asset managers. In a recent appearance on CNBC, you talked about how your firm is helping Google power data centers in Illinois, funding new energy infrastructure in Texas. Obviously, there's the battery project that we just mentioned in Indiana. Digital infrastructure and adjacent industries are very much a part of your strategy. How do you see your digital infrastructure strategy evolving at I2? And where do you see yourselves playing in the sector, if not through acquiring a major data center developer like a lot of the other asset managers have done?
I'll add to the list of what you've mentioned, the fact that through our credit fund, we've lent to AI data centers under construction. We have been active, I would say very active, but you're right. We have not done to date a AI data center platform in the United States. Of course, we've invested in data centers in Europe and Latin America and Asia and elsewhere. I think the approach is we've taken a more cautious approach, although, again, we've been building power plants, as you mentioned, with carbon sequestration and producing clean energy that will go directly to Google for the AI data center. So you're absolutely right. We're super involved, but in ways which what I like to call are focusing on singles and doubles rather than try to hit a home run. My view is that the market has exploded in a good way. I think we will be, as I mentioned earlier, looking to the use of AI in every aspect of the infrastructure chain, from the basic design of products, building a product, and then infrastructure as a service. So that is not going to change. That, in fact, is accelerating. Okay, whether we need to invest $2 trillion today in data centers or one or 500 or much more, that's a little bit open to debate. But we're certainly exploring with everyone different opportunities. Our philosophy has always been that we are very careful, we take our time, and honestly, it has helped us over the last decade plus with the kinds of returns that we've had and the kind of essentially zero losses that we've had over the last decade. So I'm not saying it's not an interesting area. I think it's a super exciting area, but we really want to be 200% sure that these are the sectors that we want to invest in. These are the particular products. And there's a lot more details than people would otherwise think.
Sadiq, thanks so much for taking the time today. I thought that was a really comprehensive discussion of both I2 and the broader infrastructure market out there. So I want to thank you for coming on the Crossroads podcast.
Jonathan, always a pleasure. Thank you.
So thanks to everyone for listening in. As I said, that was Sadiq Wahba, founder of I2 Capital. You can get the Crossroads podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. So please and share the episode if you found it interesting. And stay tuned for the next edition of Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast.